Welcome to Saving Cities. I'm Jack Story, and in each episode, a member of our team hosts a conversation with an expert in a place-related field. That could be anything from accessibility to zoning and everything in between. My guest today is Scott Beyer. Scott's an urban affairs analyst who writes for Governing Magazine, HousingOnline.com, and the Independent Institute. He also owns Market Urbanism Report, a think tank dedicated to urban policy reform. Let's get to it. Scott, thank you so much for taking time to hang out with me. Let's get started with just a little bit of background on you, yourself. How did you get into the world of market urbanism?
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in urban issues. I moved to New York City when I was in my late teens and have lived there for several years. And I've lived in several other American cities and am from Charlottesville, Virginia, which is kind of an interesting small city in its own right. So I've always been really interested in urban issues, things having to do with housing and transportation and design. And I really, I spent a lot of time researching it independently. And I'd say the way that I got involved, particularly with market urbanism, is just there was an existing market urbanism movement that came before I launched my market urbanism report. And it really focused on how free market urban policy ideas can apply to big cities and urban issues. And I really just absorbed a lot of the lessons from the early market urbanism movement and certain economic writers as well. And just kind of connected the dots of thinking that what we think of as free market economic ideas can help to solve a lot of the urban issues that are being faced in U.S. cities.
Excellent. And you kind of just did it, but if you'd like to, is there anything more specifically you'd like to say about what is market urbanism as it currently kind of sits?
Yeah, I think it's two different things. I mean, so I gave you the bird's eye view version, which is mixing free market policy and urban issues. I think to me, though, market urbanism is two separate things in the sense that on one hand, it's a theory, and on the other hand, it's a set of actual policy proposals.
Sure.
And the theory of market urbanism is asking, how would cities function if they were fully private? If rather than having, say, an elected democratic government or a common governmental system run a city, what if it were just a set of private interests that determined where housing gets built, you know, based on consumer demand, and also where transportation networks get built based on consumer demand and what private companies might want to make out of the transportation system, and also just to have private governance. And the reason that I call that a theory is that it's not a very common outcome around the world, obviously.
Right.
You know, most cities are government run. There are a handful of people experimenting with the private city model, but it's still very much of an untested idea. Now, where I would pivot then and say that market urbanism is a set of policy ideas is that really talking about specific policies that you might not say are full-on libertarianism or full-on ANCAP, but are kind of like pushing in a market-oriented direction.
Okay.
But can be applied into the modern political context. So rather than whereas a market urbanism theorist might say, well, there just shouldn't be any zoning. A pragmatic set of a market urbanism pragmatist might say, well, no, we're not going to be able to politically throw out zoning entirely. So we should at least be fighting for better zoning. And so that would be one example where I think market urbanism as a set of pragmatic policy ideas that are market oriented in nature is the version of it that I write about more, just because I think it has more, it's likelier to actually be used in the existing political context of U.S. cities.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm excited to kind of dive into some of this stuff because there's some of it I agree with and there's some of it I really don't. And that is the way these conversations, I think, should be had, right?
Okay.
We should be arguing over a bit of a battle of ideas. And I wanted to start, you guys have 39 issue areas that are outlined on your website and everyone should check it out. That'll be in the show notes. It's a really a phenomenal job of kind of laying out where you stand on a lot of issues. But as far as the Market Urbanism Report, which is your organization, is focused primarily on housing and transportation. And when it comes to housing, let's start with, what are your personal priorities, your top priorities when it comes to housing?
Well, I'd say the basic market urbanism stance on housing is that we need to do as much as possible to get the housing industry out of government hands and get it into a market-based system where the consumer and the consumer, in this case, the home buyer or renter and producer, which in this case is the developer, have as seamless of a relationship with each other that they can just build to one another's needs and not have a middleman known as the government coming in and dictating things. And so the way this distinguishes from our current paradigm is that I would say that housing is probably, and people don't realize it, but I would say it's probably among the most regulated saleable products in the United States, just in the sense that every city has a zoning code that heavily restricts where housing must be built, how it must be built, at what density, how it's supposed to lay on the lot, whether or not it has to have parking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that has, in my opinion, brought massive distortions into the industry, as regulation does with many industries. And the market urbanist idea is to get that out of the government's hands more.
It's one area that I agree with, for the most part, because I've done work in housing, specifically on the affordable housing side, which is fraught with regulation. Much of it has a genuine financial cost to it that makes some of this development it really isn't suited for long-term and productive use, right? So building the number of units necessary in a supply and demand model is never going to be done with the restrictions placed on us in terms of affordable housing. But you talk a little bit about the example on your site is Houston, Texas. You want to walk me through a little bit of why Houston is a good model to look at here in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, some parts of Houston do reflect market urbanism. Some parts of it do not. But I'd say overall, I would peg Houston as the closest thing to market urbanism in the United States. So the way in which it does reflect is, you probably know yourself that it doesn't technically have a zoning code. And so it has things that replace zoning to some degree. But the mere fact that it doesn't have a technical zoning code means that more is allowable by right through the city proper than would be allowed in most United States cities. And then, of course, the suburban areas of Houston are known to be even more pro-growth than the city proper. So where it reflects market urbanism is that it just builds a lot of housing. The Houston metro can pretty consistently beats out Dallas and New York City as the leading metro for housing permits year after year. And even if you base it on population, like permits per population, Houston is generally building more housing per capita than most metro areas around the country. I would say it's building like 3 to 4 times per 10,000 people than say really inelastic metros like San Francisco and Boston. So it's an elastic market. It builds a lot of housing. There's a lot of different types of housing all over the metro. Everything from skyscrapers popping up in random neighborhoods to little trailer parks on the outskirts of town. And what this has done is it has made it very affordable. Despite being one of the fastest growing cities in the United States decade after decade, it has home price medians that are well below the U.S. median. And so in my mind, Houston kind of debunks this idea that cities can't build their way out of the home crisis. Actually, they can have a lot of population growth and a lot of capital inflows into the metro. But if they just permit a lot of housing, the price will have a way of stabilizing and actually remaining below the national median. Now, where I don't think Houston particularly reflects the market urbanist model, and this is moving more into transportation, but I think the fact that it does build so many highways, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like a socialized model where I kind of think of our highway system as kind of like the socialized model where we collect a gas tax that is really doesn't cover the full cost of roads. And so there's a lot of additional subsidies that get thrown into road building. And then, of course, like the government is kind of building and maintaining the roads and oftentimes using eminent domain to build the roads in the first place. And so I view it as kind of like a non-market urbanist model. And Houston has more road build out by some metrics than any other metro. So it's kind of like when people say that Houston is sprawling and that there's a caveat to a lot of the housing affordability because a lot of it is being built in sprawled out areas that are auto reliant. My answer to that would be, well, that's because on one hand, there are some regulations still in the city infill area that push the housing demand out to the sprawling areas. But then also the metro subsidizes the road building out to the suburbs.
Houston, your article about housing set me on a journey. I wanted to kind of look at some of the thoughts and some of the numbers. And you talked a lot about private-owned housing permits and the associated kind of average median housing prices. And it is pretty impressive that they've managed to only grow by $44,000. That's pretty great. You didn't talk a lot, if at all, about rental pricing kind of over that same period. And there's, I think it's like nearly 40% of residents in Houston rent. And so I just kind of wanted to kind of pick your brain on where renters and rent pricing fall into that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't really studied the rental prices of Houston. When I look at these metro prices for the different metros, I usually am looking at the median home price, mm-hmm. And I'm not looking at average rents. I know that a lot of housing analysts do the latter. They look at average rents, but when I'm studying the relationship between census building permits and home prices, I'm looking at the relationship of median home prices. But I would imagine that it probably translates to rental as well. If renters are competing in a housing market where the median price is say $180,000, which is around where Houston is, I believe, mm-hmm. and then they're competing for rentals in San Francisco, where the home price median generally fluctuates between $1 million and $1.2 million, I would assume that would translate into the rents as well, as far as having lower prices in Houston than San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess that's kind of part of the conversation I was curious about in terms of, we had an economic development director here in this city that once said on a NPR that all housing is affordable if you think about it. And this was a statement that he made in regards to some of the luxury unit building that had kind of become a huge issue in our town. And that technically the argument that consistently building newer units keeps the price of then what becomes the older units reasonable is not untrue, but national rent increased by 36% over the last decade. So that same period of time that we're talking about Houston's kind of housing growth in this particular instance. Mm-hmm. And so my brain is trying to kind of wrap itself around that number as it relates to the affordability overall of housing. And I just thought maybe you had thoughts on where that ties in nationally to the argument being made about housing. Because single family ownership is down, home ownership is down across the board.
Right. Well, there's an economic term for that. It's called filtering. And it's the idea that when new housing supply is built and sold at a market rate, the added supply causes the older housing to filter down to lower prices and lower income levels. And an economist named Stuart Rosenthal did some modeling on this that determined that in a healthy market, the older housing filters down, I think, at like a 1-2% rate, in the sense that it actually depreciates in value. Now, the land values below it might still be, they're doing their own thing, but the actual housing stock depreciates in value. And so I do find that to be the case. It's kind of interesting, like somebody was making the point on Twitter the other day that in New York City, the housing filters up. Like old tenement buildings that were built in the Lower East Side back in the late 1800s that were basically like slum housing for newly arrived immigrants are now selling for millions of dollars per unit.
Right.
And so that's a case of upward filtering. But I think in most markets that are like elastic and healthy and not unnecessarily restricted, you actually do see older housing become more affordable. And so if you want to think about examples, like think of some of the first suburbs that were built outside of cities, particularly in the Midwest, and now they have dramatically declined in value, both because of population loss, but also because the housing itself is just older. And that theoretically should be reoccupied by lower income groups. And so that's what I think new housing accomplishes is it allows older housing to filter down.
I'm from Cleveland, Ohio natively, and that certainly is a truth of our city at this point. But it is directly tied to population decline, right? So when you have cities that I think are thriving or adding population, it's a curious concept. And also, I guess another part of it is the government intervention in private development, because no private developer is building something without subsidy or incentive in almost any major metropolitan area in this country. And so
you're talking about affordable housing?
No, I'm talking about just building, construction of housing units, especially in downtown areas, often, in my experience, come with some kind of incentives and workarounds that these developers will negotiate with the city. And I'm curious how that plays into the, I mean, those things drive me nuts from a governmental perspective, but how does that play in to the kind of overall theory?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of cases, new development is subsidized just because developers know there's a coterie of subsidies that they can be pursuing. And so they do it because that's their job. Everything from tax credits to just local tax breaks to various subsidies. But I mean, I think there's all kinds of examples where developers also just build new market rate housing without having any subsidies added onto it. I mean, I think there's a natural market for that. And so I think allowing new developments, even if it doesn't become affordable when it's first built, I think that still plays a role. And like I said, allowing the filtering process to occur for the other housing units. So that's why I kind of, I know that I sometimes clash with housing, like affordable housing activists about this, the idea that new housing necessarily has to be affordable. To me, that's kind of like saying new cars have to be affordable. But I think really, like, we know that people pay premiums for new cars. And if they just want any car, they go to a used car lot and they buy it at a steep discount. And that's how I'm viewing the housing market as also needing to work. I think it's kind of a fool's errand to say that, say a high-rise condo is being built and 15% of it is expected to be set aside as affordable under an inclusionary zoning mandate. I actually think that's a really bad policy because you're trying to make, you're finding the most expensive possible way to provide affordable housing and saying that the new construction has to be affordable.
I agree. The set-asides are in need of a major rework, if not just kind of abandoning them in favor of actually just subsidizing affordable units, in my personal opinion, that are separate from those. Mm-hmm. As far as the regulatory stuff, and I think that kind of gets to the heart of most of what I read of your work right? Is regulation is kind of the barrier to progress. And I agree in a lot of instances that that is unavoidably true. When we think about things like housing, transportation, or any of this, are the incentives that are in place, which you really you articulated very well, that's they're there. And so someone's job is to go take advantage of them. In a perfect kind of situation here, I'm assuming market determinism doesn't want those incentives to remain in place.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would depend on what kind of incentives you're talking about. But I'm generally against, I view that as like a vehicle to cronyism. In other words, like I don't think one developer should be able to apply for a tax break that another developer is not getting to because of his or her political connections. Like I say, there's a lot of different incentives that people can leverage. I wouldn't want to say that I'm against all incentives because they're so different that it would just depend on case by case. Like, for example, I think the historic tax credit is actually a great policy, and I've promoted like increasing it.
Right.
Surprisingly enough, I mean, somebody like me even thinks that's good. And historic tax credits are used to underwrite projects. And the reason I think it's so good is that it helps developers repair historic facades and structures that otherwise, financially speaking, they would have to tear down because it costs too much to repair. Absolutely. So, I mean, that would be one specific case where it's like the incentive actually is, I think, a good policy. Other incentives like low-income housing tax credits, I'm a little lukewarm. I mean, I'm not adamantly against, but I think the program could be reformed.
And, absolutely. Unquestionably.
But overall, like, I don't really think incentives, particularly at the city level, are really necessary. And I think developers would build without them.
That's, I'm super curious about that. And then the flip side of that is there's a lot of jobs now in that bureaucratic muck, right? There is a lot of people whose livelihoods now depend on money from navigating things. And you used a perfect example. Low-income housing tax credit is a full-time job for a lot of people, a lot of people. Does that kind of gutting of that concept or reimagining of that from a market urbanism standpoint, do those jobs factor into the equation and in the pragmatic sense, right? So you talked about the theoretical market urbanism and then kind of the practical implementation-oriented market urbanism. Where do jobs inside of that process go? Or fall inside of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, like you said, the fact that LIHTC has become so complex that there's whole industries dedicated to interpreting it, not only in the government bureaucracy, but the legal profession and the syndicators who end up taking the tax credits and selling them to financial institutions. Like, that's a whole profession that has risen out of the complexity of that program. And to me, it speaks to the fact that the program is not really that good. And it's sort of like the money that's going for that cannot be used to actually build the housing. And so it's getting lopped off. I think from a market urbanism perspective, the alternative to that would be a voucher system where kind of like Section 8, although I think Section 8 unto itself, that there's reforms to that that could happen. But I like the idea of Section 8 much more because basically a voucher is going directly to the people in need who actually need the housing. It's not going to the developers. It's not Correct. Going to the syndicators. It's going to the people who need the housing, and then they can shop the open market. And it's effectively just supplementing their income to be able to afford housing.
So that's great, because I actually took a note on this, and it was a part of your homelessness kind of positioning, right? And so I think it's important to point out a couple of important statistics about homelessness, because they're relevant to, I think, the overall argument that you guys are making. And according to one study I saw with the National Alliance to End Homelessness, a chronically homeless person costs the taxpayer an average of $35,578 a year. And they did a study in 2017, I think, that showed how costs on average are reduced by almost 50%, 49.5% when they're placed in supportive housing, permanent supportive housing. It ends up netting roughly $403 million in annual savings for taxpayer money to put homeless folks in permanent supportive housing. That seems like a no-brainer. Like that just flat economic argument seems like a no-brainer. And the reason I'm bringing it up based on what you just talked about is the article on your site kind of opaquely argues for basic income over Section 8, like a UBI over a housing choice voucher for exactly the reasons you just stated. I'm all for that. I think that's absolutely the right way to do this. But I'm curious how that kind of ties into the platform you're promoting.
Well, I can't say that I can't say I'm a UBI proponent. I mentioned it in the article, and it's at least something to think about. I think the execution of it and the cost would be something that needs to be discussed before it were fully tried. But sure. In respect to homelessness, I think the market urbanism take on homelessness really looks into the complexities of the issue and the fact that there's not any one type of homeless person. And so I've really fleshed out more. I'm writing a book on market urbanism as right now anyway. And so I'm fleshing out the idea a little bit more than I did probably on that document you're looking at online. But what I'm realizing is that there's kind of three macro situations going on with homelessness. So on one hand, and this is particularly a problem in the really expensive coastal markets, is there's people who are simply the working homeless. They don't necessarily have mental illnesses or drug addiction problems, which is often the stereotype. They simply don't make enough to be able to afford housing in the markets that they live in. And so the market urbanism answer to that is really straightforward. We just got to build more housing. We need to build more housing so that there is more affordable housing coming into the pipeline that they can live in. Now, I think the homeless issue becomes more complicated, though. The second kind of homeless person is not the working homeless, but it's somebody who might be struggling with drug addiction and substance abuse. And so that's a completely different situation. Those are people who do need help. And I think they are capable of turning their lives around. And so I've studied some what's called transitional housing models, where people who enter a program, they're taught life skills, not only job skills, but things like emotional intelligence, how to respond to conflicts and base themselves on conflict resolution, and really just like reenter society and become productive members of society. And I've studied some models that are very good for a very cost-effective price of getting people through those transitional housing programs and back into self-sufficiency.
Yeah, those are some of the best programs. I agree. I've seen some firsthand. Now, the only issue, and I know that it's the issue that they have all described to me, those folks that I've talked to that work in that, are that the timeframes that their funding allows for an individual to actually stay in that transitional housing becomes part of the issue with the chronic homelessness, right? So I think the handful that are in our local area have somewhere between 3 to 6 months maximum in transitional housing.
That's pretty short.
It's pretty short, right? Like that's, you're asking quite a bit of somebody to find stability, educate themselves in a new manner of living, and be able to then take on that responsibility on their own when they have not been able to in the past. 3 to 6 months is a very short time frame. What are the time frames of the transitional housing opportunities you've seen?
The two really good ones that I studied were both 2 years.
Oh, that's far better.
And they relied a lot on philanthropic funding. So it's not the type of thing that's going to pay for itself. You know,
no, of course not.
It does need funding. But then that segues into the third type of homeless situation, which are people who are just mentally ill and they cannot be expected to help themselves. And that would be where I would support a housing first solution of getting them into permanent supportive housing. But I think where market urbanism would be different than just say a normal urbanist is I think a lot of the urbanism movement has looked at the permanent supportive housing situation as like, that is the main strategy that we need to be doing for the homeless. Whereas I would say, well, no, wait, because even putting people in permanent supportive housing forever is going to be expensive. And so if there's like transitional housing models that could get people more effectively into self-sufficiency, I would favor that over what effectively is just a lifelong giveaway of permanent supportive housing. And so, but I think all three are needed, and it just depends on the situation.
I agree. Everything has to have a multi-pronged approach, right? And whether or not I agree with some of the more hardline opinions on either side of that, you're not going to solve any of the problems we're talking about here with a single solution. No one of these things has a single bullet solution. Let's talk a little bit more about transportation.
Okay.
Same question that I asked you about housing. What is kind of the personal priority when it comes to transportation as it stands right now?
Well, I think it's really two-pronged, and this is something that I'm laying out in my book, so I feel like I can give a better answer than I did even, than I would have even a couple months ago. But I think on one hand, I'm really interested in bringing market-based pricing to urban right-of-way. So we're talking things like not only roads, but curb space. I think that's a really important one as well, parking. And then once you've brought market-based pricing to urban right-of-way, you then give transportation companies full license to use that right-of-way based on what they're willing to pay for. And so a concrete example I could give is, as a market urbanist, I see the rise in bike share, like dockless bike share, as a really promising trend. But it hasn't really taken off in cities because the right-of-way issues are still there, and they're kind of like preventing these companies from scaling. And I would say in a market urbanist paradigm, well, in a non-market urbanist paradigm, the issue is, oh, well, the dockless bike users just drop their bikes everywhere, and so they're laying all over the sidewalks, and everybody's really angry, and they have no place to go. And in a market urbanist paradigm, we would say, no, basically give them an opportunity to buy space that they can take out in the existing right-of-way network and then park those bikes there. So rather than having, say, giving away free parking to automobile users in a parking space, let the bike share companies buy bike storage in that space, and they outbid the driver for the right to park that storage there. And that would give bike share companies a place to park. And so that's the kind of model that I think could apply to a lot of different companies, not just bike share. It would be a broadly applied thing to all transport modes.
I like the topic of microtransit, though, because that was one of the areas that I actually spent time on your website. And you kind of outlined the virtues of microtransit versus macrotransit. And I agree largely with that assessment, but it highlights a lot more kind of government intervention than most of your other platforms that I've seen, right? It really, and I know from living in Columbus, Ohio, currently, we were an early adopter of Kogo bikes, I think was the first big one that we brought in a bike share situation. But the city was on the hook for that, right? The city had to participate financially in making that available. And even then, the program itself, while I think promising and certainly has evolved over the last five or six years, it's required a lot of bureaucracy to oversee its appropriate maintained use, because the private market, I think we've had three or four different, from electronic scooters or electric scooters to, I think we have electric bikes now, and they're all different companies. But some of those companies abandon their stuff. A lot of those companies are biased against low and moderate income neighborhoods, right? There's a lot of stuff that uses the infrastructure that we all pay for. Where does that responsibility fall? Is that government responsibility to help make sure that those private entrepreneurs are holding up their end of the bargain? Like, where does that fall in terms of this?
Well, it's kind of just what I described. It's not that the government, I don't necessarily think the government needs to come in and subsidize the bike share program. I do think that the government needs to allow the bike share program to exist, though. And I think the easiest way to do that is, once again, to settle with the right-of-way issue and really have more innovative thinking of how right-of-way can be used to accommodate this new upstart industry. And so you probably noticed when I was talking about housing as well, it's kind of like the housing status quo in the United States is geared away from density and towards sprawl.
Yep.
And the way that it does that is through zoning. And The only the only real type of zoning that we have to any great degree throughout the United States is single family sprawl zoning. And it's kind of the same with transportation. It's like the use of right-of-way is geared towards the automobile and away from the alternatives. And so everything having to do with road space, curb space, really even sidewalk space when you think about it, because a lot of sidewalk space is just dedicated to signage for cars. And so it's kind of the same deal. It's like we have this one-track mindset of thinking that all of our urban space should be dedicated to sprawl and cars. And I think in the situation like a Columbus or a Dallas or a Seattle or various other cities that have had trouble with bikes, they need to be thinking about how they can retrofit their right-of-way for these new uses. And I personally think it is best done through a pricing system. Like I said before, rather than just giving away curb space for free car parking,
right?
Either give away or contract out curb space for bike parking.
Hmm. And then whoever leases that's in charge of maintenance, correct? Like in that model, in that theory.
Right. Exactly. So, and again, this is kind of getting to the extreme market urbanism versus the pragmatic market urbanism. But I have read about models where even specific curb spaces are straight up sold to companies. And then those companies can use the curb space and the sidewalk space to build permanent structured facilities that help with their business model. So an example of that could be like, say you're in New York City and there's a private bus company, like say Uber Bus. Uber has a bus model that they're rolling out in various global cities. Say they want to come to New York City and they're dealing with the issue of, well, where is an Uber bus going to park or pull over to pick up their passengers? Because Obviously so much of the parking space, so much of the space is going to free parking and so much more of it is going to like bus pullovers. And so where does Uber Bus play into all of that? Well, in an extreme market urbanism model, I might say, let Uber decide which curbs, like where it wants to pull over to pick passengers up, let them buy that curb space permanently. And then they can build structured bus shelters into the sidewalk effectively or into the curb. So, and then you don't have this issue with like double parking and traffic congestion and things like that. Uber is finally given space to operate, but it's space that they paid for.
Right. And so the one issue that just pops into my mind on that is the restrictive resale. There would have to be some guiding principles for Uber, and let's say Uber decides it no longer wants to own that space, or it's bankrupt entirely, or whatever happens, because companies have ebbs and flows, right? Mm-hmm. And at what point is Uber accountable to making sure that their now owned infrastructure inside of a city is resold, leased, however they want to do it, to another transportation-oriented group? How does that stop from spiraling down and becoming like a REIT of available curbs in infrastructure?
Well, maybe it does become that. And that would be kind of like an interesting model, because then you would have multiple user, like multiple companies using that space as well. And so it becomes like more of a co-op for curb space or whatever. But yeah, I think the transaction would happen the same way it does with anything else. It's sort of like if you are done living in a house and you're not just going to leave it empty, like you want to sell it to a second home buyer so that you can recoup the money from your asset. And I think the buying and selling of curb space could theoretically operate similarly in a city. Now, granted, this is the extreme model.
Yeah. No, I like the argument. I like having the conversation. I think it's important.
I think the less extreme model, and probably the more realistic, would be the city still owns the curb space, because I think people would flip their lid if a city began selling off its curb space to companies like Uber.
Probably.
So I think a more pragmatic, politically realistic model would be the city continues to own the curb space, but it does lease out use of it. And then the city obviously then collects the money and can use it to reinvest in the community. And that can be basically a user fee revenue stream that funds city operations or funds the maintenance of the curb. And then it always remains in the city ownership. But I do like the idea of a city leasing out its curb space rather than just having sort of like this mushy non-market, non-really, I don't know. It's sort of like cities own a lot of curb space now, and it's very valuable property, and they have no mechanism for determining what its value really is, mm-hmm. or for really managing it in any sort of rational way. It's sort of like an interest group, like homeowners will just come to the city and say, we want this curb space for free parking. But it's sort of like, okay, so you're going to give it away to this one interest group without really charging for it or recouping any value for it. And it doesn't make much sense to me. I think a market leasing process is more practical.
I actually don't mind the idea of it. Have there been studies done on what the percentage of that, like as a starting point? Right. Because it's not going to be 100% of city owned curbs being leased. Mm-hmm. Is there a model that has figured out some way to figure out what the right percentage of starting point is?
Well, the idea itself is so rarely discussed that I don't know if I can't really say that many cities even try it. So I couldn't give you a percentage on what the right model is anyway, because nobody's trying it. Hmm. I think the closest thing would be when cities put parking meters on their curb space and charge for people to park. That's kind of like a very crude, primitive model of what I'm talking about, but it's basically the most common one you'll see. And even then, I think in most cases, cities undercharge for curb space parking. I know that one city that does have like a dynamic market-based parking meter system is San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So particularly in their more business-oriented non-residential areas, they have parking meters that adjust dynamically based on the market demand for parking at a specific hour. And so that's kind of what I'm talking about. But I think for every situation like that, you'll have 10 situations where you drive downtown, you park in a parking space, and they're charging you 50 cents an hour. And obviously that's an undervalued use of that space.
Yeah, no, that is an argument amongst a great many of my friends in that field, because parking meters they're evolving, right? So it's easier to do that kind of time-based or resource-based pricing.
You say you're in Columbus? Digital.
Yeah, Columbus, Ohio.
What is the hourly rate to park downtown there?
It varies now pretty dramatically, but you're looking at probably anywhere from outskirty, you're paying $75 or 75 cents to a buck per hour, to when you're on the inside, probably closer to 2 to 3, depending on where you're at.
Oh, so it sounds like you have dynamic pricing.
We have implemented some versioning of dynamic pricing. You know, it seems to be shifting every couple of months here and there in complexity. Yeah, we replaced all of the coin operated stuff with digital meters. And now there's, I think we just last year moved to like full on apps. So all the city owned and controlled street parking is done through an app. And
yeah, you know, in Charlottesville, we tried to put those parking meters in place and they got removed because people complained. People were used to parking for free. And in my opinion, the free parking causes all kinds of like tragedy of the commons type issues. You know, people are always circling and adding to downtown congestion because they're looking for the free parking. I think having metered parking would have made much more sense, but people complained. And so we removed the meters. So it's kind of like when I'm thinking of these abstract hypermarket urbanist concepts of leasing curb space and selling curb space, we're not even close to there. I mean, right. We can't, in most parts of America, we can't even convince people to have metered parking. So it's kind of like, this is a very uphill battle. And it's, and in that sense, it's kind of an abstraction, but it is an idea.
I think it's fascinating. I like to have this conversation for much longer. The last thing I'll say about it is it kind of mimics the idea of congestion pricing, which is a huge conversation happening in a lot of different ways. Can you explain congestion pricing?
Yeah. So my favorite kind of, I think you could call it a on one hand, it's congestion pricing, which is usually the pricing of access into a city center by road. But then you also have things like toll pricing, right, which is usually applied to interstates and highways and in between cities, and but kind of follows the same model. The model being that an electronic transponder determines the price of using the road or entering a given area at a certain time based on the demand for entering that area. And so the idea is that during peak congestion hours, the price is higher, and that discourages so many people from getting on the road at that point. In a non-peak hours, the price goes lower. So it has a way of distributing traffic and dispersing traffic and preventing bottlenecks. And so I think that's they're close cousins. The idea, right, of not only congestion pricing and tolls, but also curb pricing. It's the same basic concept. It is managing demand through a price information mechanism.
It's really interesting stuff. And the primary question I have on it is those peak times obviously tend to be related to work, the work-oriented peaks. When you look at the actual breakdown, most of us don't have control over when we need to be at work. Mm-hmm. Right. So how does that not negatively impact someone who has to be on the road during peak hours? Mm-hmm. Are there considerations in the models that you have seen for that reality?
I actually think there should be, because what you're describing is something that could be regressive. Here's a specific example that I saw recently where, New Jersey tried to increase the tolls on some of its turnpikes and state highways. And some social justice groups came out and said, no, this is actually going to be regressive. It's going to hit the poor the hardest.
Right.
And I think my answer to that would be, if there's very specific people who need assistance, given the increase in tolls, then maybe they can apply for something at the end of the year, basically saying, this is the money I had to spend on tolls and can you reimburse me? And I'd be okay with the state government reimbursing them.
Got it.
Now, the thing is, though, is that New Jersey's median household income is something like, it's pretty high. It's one of the highest in the United States. I think it's something like 80,000 or something.
Yeah.
So I'll wager that most people who are using the roads in New Jersey can probably afford the toll hike. And it's really just a matter of helping the people who can't. But if you have a reasonable salary, to me, you should be expected to pay the market price for the road. You'll still be able to afford it and still have access.
So let's take a generic bank headquarters that's located outside the city, and their employees have an average drive time of 20 minutes to and from, right? And they're required to be there at a specific time and leave work at a specific time. And thus the peak pricing on that is going to be absurd. But does the company have any liability there in that model? Like, you're telling it to work for you, I get paid X, but I have to drive at this time and this time, and that's going to raise my, that's going to cut into the money you're paying me. Does the hypothetical bank that I'm talking about have some responsibility to subsidize their employees in that model, or no?
Well, I think should is a strong word, because I think it's that's between the bank and the employees.
Sure.
And so the bank might give them a higher salary. They might give them some sort of stipend for the parking. I mean, for the use of the road. Another way the bank might respond would be if road usage is highest from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. because that's the peak hour, maybe you open at 10.
Right.
And sure, and they use the roads from 9 to 10. And that's actually like, that's the entire point. Like, that's exactly what congestion pricing is trying to accomplish. It's causing people to adjust slightly so that traffic disperses more across the day and it's not everybody using the road at one time.
Yeah, no, I think the theory of it's brilliant. I can see where it gets tripped up as far as being able to be effectively communicated.
Well, yeah.
It feels overwhelming, right? I mean, the implementation of it, I know that technologically we could absolutely do it. There's no issue there, but it is a complicated beast.
Yeah, well, I think what you're where you're going there is it's politically unlikely. Kind of in the same way that parking meters are politically unlikely still in a lot of places, because when people are used to using something for free, they don't want to suddenly have to pay for it. And it's sort of like you can take the economic arguments and all this sort of the wonky jingo, but it's sort of like if it's against people's financial self-interest, then they're probably not going to want to do it. That said, Stockholm, Sweden, they experimented with congestion pricing. I think they did a 6-month trial, and then they had a vote as to whether or not to make it permanent. And I was just reading on Streets blog the other day that that vote turned out being 52% favorable. So I think when people see that, like when they're actually able to see the benefits in the sense that you pay a little more, but you don't have to deal with as much congestion. Mm-hmm. Maybe you get some people off the road, so you're not having so much automobile impacts that are kind of hurting the city and causing exhaust and noise and all that. When people see the benefits of congestion pricing, apparently in Stockholm, at least, they voted favorably for it.
Yeah, my view on it is constantly shifting and evolving. I think the core of it's really a sound theory, and I'm excited to see where it goes. It should be fun to watch what happens with that. And I'm sure your book will tackle some of that. Mm-hmm. I look forward to reading it. Scott, thank you so much, man, for your time. This conversation is awesome. I hope we can do this again. We barely scratched the surface of so much of this, and I think efforts like the Market Urbanism Report and the work that you're doing are absolutely required if we're going to have an honest look at all the possible solutions to stuff. These aren't small challenges our places are facing. Where can people keep up with you and what you're working on and make sure that they get notified when that book comes out?
MarketUrbanismReport.com is my blog. If you really want to get to the center of the market urbanism movement, as far as like everybody who's involved, you want to go to the Market Urbanism Report Facebook group. It's a group with 10,000 plus members, and we have really rabid conversations on there every day.
Excellent. Will you give me that information when we get offline here, and I'll make sure to put it in the show notes.
Will do.
Awesome. Thanks again, Scott. This has been great.
Thank you, Jack.
That's it for this episode. Again, I'm Jack Story, and thanks for listening. If you found this conversation to be worthy of your time, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss another episode. Take care and see you next time.